So I had oral surgery this week, so my capacity to speak with my face mouth is greatly hampered. Hey, welcome to the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, the show where I speak to the best artist about telling true stories, teasing out origins, habits, and routines so that you can apply some of those tools of mastery to improve your own work. What's going on, CNFers, my CNF buddies? I recorded this interview prior to the surgery with
Ellen Stekkendal,
our Norwegian medical student and sexual health educator. So I sound like a human person through the interview. She, along with
Nina Brockman,
wrote The Wonder Down Under, The Insider's Guide to the Anatomy, Biology, and Reality of the Vagina. It's quite a fun read. Both
Ellen Stekkendal
and
Nina Brockman
are touring the U.S. as we speak, since the book caught fire after their TEDx Oslo talk about the virginity fraud, breaking myths about the hymen and such. Got nearly, it's up around 3 million views about now, so go take a look in the show notes. I spoke only with
Ellen Stekkendal
for this episode because
Nina Brockman
got sick at the last minute. So with Ellen, we hit on how her curiosity led her to women's health, co-authoring a book and co-writing a TED Talk, how the lack of information can ruin lives, and processing a new sense of global visibility. So now a little housekeeping. I'd love for you to subscribe to the show so you can get one of these nifty little podcasts every Friday. Also, if you leave an honest review on iTunes, I'll edit or coach up a piece of your work of up to 2,000 words. You give me 1 minute of your review time, I'll give you a couple hours of mine. Not a bad deal. Okay, now it's time to hear the brilliant
Ellen Stekkendal
for episode 92. Wow.
Days, and then we're going to Chicago, and then San Francisco, then Seattle, and then Los Angeles.
That's amazing. So are you surprised with how the book has caught fire? Almost, it really ignited so quickly. I mean, what's been the experience like of really just riding this momentum on this book? It must be pretty exciting.
Well, it has been nuts, really. We never imagined to sell the book to any country outside of Norway, and we didn't really imagine that it would go that well in Norway either. So this is still kind of a big shock for us, and especially the fact that we can travel. We never thought that we would go to the US with our book and have a translation in English. So it has been great. It's like a fun adventure, but still I think both of us are a bit sad that this book is still needed and wanted that much in 2018, because it's like basic information about women's health, and it is so popular because people don't have any sources to go to when looking for answers to their questions about sex, bodies, health. So, these are topics we don't talk enough about.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But in the way you guys write about it is so, frank and light and fun that it is extremely accessible. I finished the book earlier this weekend, and it was, as someone who studied a lot of biology myself, it was just a really fun and deeply informative read, and I learned just a ton. And I came in with a somewhat maybe higher baseline of knowledge just based on some of my biology studies, and it was still amazing me how little I knew. So I mean, it must have been, like you said, it was kind of sad in a way that that the book is needed in 2018.
Yeah, but so, I mean, most people that we talk to, even with medical backgrounds, learn a lot, because medicine isn't really, prioritizing everyday women's ailments. So facts about I don't know, discharge and menstrual pains, things that women have to deal with every day. It's not really considered disease, so it's not talked about that much in medicine either. So we kind of everyday women's health kind of falls between two chairs.
Yeah, and so like let's back up a little bit. I'd love to get a sense of kind of like where you grew up, what kind of kid you were, and how you ultimately became interested in biology and female reproductive system, and how this became really a sort of galvanized as a life's passion and work for you. So like when you were growing up, at what point did your curiosity turn into something that grew into something much deeper?
Well, I've always been curious in topics of science and biology. I remember that I got this toy microscope from my parents when I was maybe 6 years old, and looked at wings of insects and plants, and just I was curious and wanted to study the things that were around me. And when I went to school, I always liked science class. I come from a family with my father is a geophysicist and my mother is a teacher in chemistry. So I really came from a background where science was talked a lot about in at home, and we always had discussions about, I don't know, biology, mathematics. So that was kind of a natural interest for me. And also, I always read a lot as a kid, both fiction and non-fiction. And I don't know, that also built up a wish to write for me. So from a very, very young age, I wanted to write. So this project has kind of merged several of my passions, like my passion for medicine and science, and also my passion to write and to make information accessible for every reader, something I had a lot of. It was I always liked to read popular science as a kid to read simplified scientific materials. So yeah, this is kind of a combination of these passions for me.
Yeah, that's wonderful. What were some books and some writers that really inspired you to at some point or in some point in your future to pick up the pen and do your own writing and try to convey some of the esoteric messages of science into more like layman's terms? Like who were some of those authors that really that kind of almost gave you permission to do it yourself?
Well, I didn't read any, good popular science as a kid. So that was when I was older in my late teens and early 20s. That must have been, well, the best example of that must be Julia Enders, and her book Gut came out a few years ago in the US also. She's a German, oh, she was a German medical student, and wrote her book about about the taboo topic as a medical student. And that was very, both Nina and I thought that that was very brave, since medicine is really a hierarchical structure. You are not really supposed to talk that much about what you know when you're a student or a junior doctor. So we just thought she was very brave to kind of write a book like that to the public without being an expert. I mean, she's now much deeper into the science behind that, but she wrote Gut as a medical student. So I think that gave us permission to try as well, because we wrote The Wonder Down Under as medical students. I'm still in my last year at medical school, so we are in no way like experts in this field. We're not specialized in gynecology or venerology, so there are a lot of people who know a lot more about single topics in our book than we do. But we had the opportunity to simplify and popularize it for a broader audience, and Julia Enders really showed that that was possible for us. So, and also from an American writer, I really like Mary Roach, her book Stiff, about cadavers. That is one of my favorites, popular science reads.
How did you get your start in, specifically with, you had the broader interest in just science and biology, and then at what point did you start to get really specific towards, towards women's health, which ultimately leads to the blog and then the TEDx talk and then the book? But let's kind of like work our way through that. So at what point did you really start to hone in your focus on women's health?
Well, in 2011, when I started medical school at the same time as Nina, I volunteered to do this sexual education program for youths in Norway, and also refugees and sex workers. I realized when I started working with sexual education that the lack of information can really ruin people's lives in a very profound way. I mean, by giving people the knowledge, or by making people understand that they are normal and good enough the way they are, that can really change how they feel about themselves. Because when it comes to taboo topics, the insecurities and questions that people have, they don't really know where to turn to get the answers. They don't really know where to turn to be told that that they are normal. And when it comes to female sexual health especially, there has been so much shame, insecurities, and also misconceptions that makes it hard to be, I think, a woman who is interested in her own sexuality, especially if you are a woman who experienced some physiological process that you don't understand and may think that something is wrong with you. There are several, well, our TEDx talk about the hymen is, I think, the most important example on how, female anatomy is the story we tell about female anatomy is distorted to serve some purpose. Because we have always been told that the hymen is kind of a virginity seal that's supposed to break and you're supposed to bleed the first time you have sex. And this is very useful for societies who want to control female sexuality and women in their everyday lives. When we started with the sexual education classes, we saw how parents of young immigrant children in Norway were afraid to let their young girls participate in normal everyday activities like bicycling, maybe using tampons, because they were afraid that they would ruin themselves and their honor from doing these activities. So the control that you get from creating myths about things like the hymen, it's broader than just controlling women's sexual life. It's also controlling their everyday lives. We had a lot of examples where we understood in our sexual education classes that by giving certain pieces of information, you could really change how people were thinking about themselves. And that's when I started to think that this work is really worthwhile and important, and not a lot of people are working in this field. So I thought we could do a lot of good by focusing on sexual health.
Yeah, and you say the lack of information can ruin lives. And what was your experience with, or what has been some of the experience you've had with the refugees and maybe the fear that they feel based on the information that they've been given versus what's, you know, what's real, like the stuff that you're trying to educate people on and the stuff that they probably inherently feel scared of or shameful of. Like, what has been your experience with that?
Yeah, young women who are tell us stories about how they or friends have you know, experienced hard situations with their families because of their hymen, for example, lack of bleeding. Also, we have been approached by women who have turned to the healthcare system to get help, for example, by getting, you know, virginity certificates or surgical procedures to change the look of their hymen. Those are, you know, common stories that we got all the time and that we still get through feedback on our TED talk. Yeah, these are examples that when we know that the hymen doesn't work that way, it's very hard to know that this is still happening. There are, of course, also different aspects of sexual health that's especially important to immigrant societies in Norway and other countries. For example, female genital mutilation. We spoke to one woman once who was trying to get pregnant with her husband, and they didn't make it. And then we realized that they had been having anal sex because she had been subjected to genital mutilation. She was had been infibulated, which is the process when the outer labia is sewn together, so there's only like a little hole left for urine, menstrual fluid, and of course, unless you are opened again, it's impossible to become. It's impossible to have normal vaginal sex, it sounds maybe absurd that someone wouldn't know that you couldn't get pregnant from anal sex, but if no one told you, then how would you know? And again, this shows how education is so important in every culture. And just to underline that, the myths about the hymen have consequences for women from more conservative cultures, but the same myths still exists in the West and also in Norway. I mean, a lot of young girls that are Norwegian, that are white, are also, you know, scared that it will hurt, that they will bleed too much, and we still look differently at female virginity than we do at male virginity. So this is a problem that's everywhere in all cultures, even if the consequences are worse in the more conservative ones.
You know, you're alluding to like education and knowledge here is power, and often a lot of powerful people don't want to have certain people or certain people educated because it will give them knowledge that will empower them. And you're giving lots of people empowerment and education in with your work and your writing. Have you experienced any pushback from people who don't want women to know everything about, you know, their bodies and their biology? Like, have you experienced any pushback from people from more conservative cultures?
Luckily, very little yet. But I mean, the book is just recently out in the US. So currently, we have only been subjected to critique in Scandinavia and parts of Europe. And the culture, I mean, in Europe is also different from the culture in the US. So we'll wait and see if someone reacts. We have gotten some critique from actually a Danish conservative politician, but that wasn't necessarily about how it's bad to empower people. It was more the fact that, well, she compared us to children who are fascinated by their feces.
Jeez.
Yeah, it's kind of a, you know, control technique.
Yeah.
Very condescending. Her reaction was, should nothing be hidden anymore? Should nothing be secret? And what about the mystery? Shouldn't anything be a mystery? But and that's a common reaction that we get. Also, a lot of men may feel that if we talk very openly about normal physiological female processes, then some of the magic disappears. I mean, the fact that something is secret, that hurts people, because if it's secret, then you won't know if you're normal. So,
or you'll try to get pregnant by having anal sex if you don't.
I mean, yeah.
Don't get fully educated. So, yeah.
Yeah, so we need to be open about these issues in, I think, in a objective way. It's not about. It's not about, well, every person doesn't necessarily have to talk about their own discharge or their own periods. I mean, Nina and I certainly are not talking about ourselves, but we're talking about medicine in the general way. And we're trying to be open about sexuality in a general way. And I think that's very important.
I'd love to hear your take on the differences in culture too, like from Europe to the United States, and maybe for people who aren't as familiar with Scandinavian and Europe at large in terms of the sex education culture and how it is in the States. Like, what have you noticed as a difference between cultures in your experience?
My impression is that in the US, some people are very open and eager for education, but you have a lot of strong conservative forces. The way I understand it, like every child in the US does not get sexual education. That's true, right?
No, yeah, I believe it depends where you are in the country. There are definitely very conservative states, and like say in the far south, that sometimes definitely stay away from that, and some of the places up north are more progressive like that. But yeah, by and large, you're right.
Yeah, so but it's difficult, of course, to talk about the US as a country, because you're more of a like a continent with such different peoples. But one concrete example that we have noticed is that whenever we're giving talks in the US or having lectures, we are asked, is this suitable for teenagers? And we have never been asked those questions in Europe, because most people assume that sexual education is for teenagers only. I think that's one strange difference, that a lot of the people that are arranging these lectures that we have are scared that we would, I don't know, teach the teenagers something that they shouldn't know, which has never been the case in Europe.
And with so much of what you write about in the book, from, you know, the very sensitive, polarizing topics, you know, the virgin fraud of the, you know, the myths surrounding the hymen, abortion, you know, the very detailed, elucidating stuff about menstruation, everything. And then you guys ultimately decided to talk about the virginity fraud for your TEDx talk. And so what was the discussions that you and Nina were having when you decided to focus on that as your talk?
Well, it came very natural to us, because I think that is the most important topic that we work with. These myths still have such extreme consequences for women It's so strange to us that the information has been known for so long, but that it hasn't reached even the educated population. I mean, I watched an episode of Girls the other day, there is a scene where Hannah's editor tells her that, or is trying to tell her that she wrote a very dull article. And he uses the phrase, Hannah, did your hymen grow back?
Oh.
So, I mean, even in Girls, even in, we have a lot of, we've been looking at a lot of television series to find examples on where the hymen is misrepresented. And when you do that, I mean, it's everywhere. Popular culture is making this myth stay alive. And so are doctors when they keep writing virginity certificates, they keep doing these surgical procedures. So it's so absurd. We've known for more than 100 years that the hymen doesn't necessarily change during intercourse, and that a lot of women doesn't bleed. In our TED talk, we mentioned an article from 1906 by a Norwegian doctor, in which she is present where a forensic doctor is comparing the hymen of a sex worker to that of, he's trying to determine whether a woman is a sex worker or not. And he thinks she's a virgin, but she's an experienced sex worker. So we can't tell the difference. And that is a 1906 paper. And still we are replicating this myth. So it's so absurd. And so it was a lot of fun to do the research. And we felt that also the work has been very worthwhile.
And you and Nina both share the stage for the talk. And so how did you guys go about structuring that talk so you weren't in competition with one another, but complementing each other? Like, how did you guys workshop that and then ultimately bring it to the stage?
Yeah, we had to quarrel a bit with the TEDx team to make that happen, because usually they only take single speakers. But we've done everything together, and we really thought that it would be better if we were two. They didn't believe us, but now I think we were right. So what we did, we wrote together, we practiced a lot, we even stood up on chairs in Nina's kitchen and sung our manuscripts to different melodies, shouted it. I mean, we tried it out until we thought it was good enough. And for us who aren't, English native speakers, it took a lot of practice to feel secure. But I think we did a good job with it, just to split the information evenly. And it was good to work with the props together as two people that couldn't have worked as one person, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what was the experience like co-authoring a book too? Say the book has like a nice sort of uniform voice to it, so you don't say like, oh, that's clearly Nina writing, or that's clearly Ellen writing. And, it does have this kind of a uniform feel to it. So how did you guys achieve that in the book?
We split the topics in two and did half the research for each part, and then we wrote the first draft, and then we swapped, and then we edited each other's text so much that the tone in the end became somewhere in the middle of the two of us. So that was also very, it came very natural to us to do it that way. None of us had ever written a book before, so that's how we did it.
Yeah, and given that you haven't, again, neither of you had written a book before, and you're coming from, say, like non-writing backgrounds, because you're coming at it from medical and as scientists, was there any reluctance or a fear of approaching it as a book project, were you guys just kind of like fearless and you're just like, yeah, let's just let it rip and go? Like, what was that experience like?
Well, I remember, especially Nina had a lot of fear, but in a different way. It was more like, are we good enough in the medical field to spread this knowledge? I mean, we did that and we tried it out. So that was the scary part. I think both of us have always been very passionate about writing and done a lot of writing for ourselves. We weren't scared about that. I think also, I think we are both confident in our writing skills. So that wasn't a problem for us.
Yeah, a lot of people, that listen to this show and that I've spoken to, as a writer myself, is that there's a people have this vision of what their book is in their head, and then when they start to actually maybe write some of it down, it's not congruent or matching the vision they have in their head. So they stop and they get blocked and they get fearful and then they just stop doing the work. Like, did you guys experience any of that kind of hiccup? You're like, all right, we've got this blog, we've got the book we want in our head, but it's just not manifesting itself. But it appears like you guys just muscled through. So maybe how did you approach the writing and power through your drafts to get to your final product?
Well, we each of us had a lot of periods during the writing process in which we felt that we sucked at writing, even if we were confident when we started. But the funny thing was that whenever I felt like I'd done shit work, Nina could take over and say that, oh no, these parts are really good, and if we change this and this, then this is a great text. And then when she had similar feelings of fear and I don't know, imposter syndrome, then I could take over and do the same for her. So we were strangely matched in the fact that we never had a block at the same time. So that was lucky for us.
That's incredible that you could kind of offset some of the creative burden on the other person. If you were just like in a rut, the other person could pick up the slack.
Yeah, and I think a lot of writers, well, most of writers write alone, right? So this is not an experience that most people have had. So I think that's the great and interesting thing about writing together. And also, Nina and I share the same background. We have the same opinions on this topic. We have a certain, we have a different approach to style, I think, in some aspect. But that was, I think, these differences that we had and sacrifices I had to make to change it the way she liked sometimes, that was worth it when I'm thinking about the times when I just didn't feel like I could write. So if I'd done this alone, it would have been so much more difficult. So this was a good project to be two on,
And
I think.
when you guys were writing the book, did you guys like share an office while you did it, or were you kind of like you would write something and then email it to her, or were you guys always in the same room?
No, we wrote the first drafts and did the research separately, and then we met up and had like one weekend a month where we, ruined each other's texts to try to make them better. We did the first drafts alone. Nina had just given birth to her son, so she wrote in the evenings after he was asleep, and I wrote at school a lot since I was taking classes at medical school at that time, so tried
That's
to fit it in between.
that's incredible, because a lot of people, they may make excuses that they don't have the time, and really what it is that people have a hard time prioritizing the time to write the book they want to write, do the research they want to do. And it's like, geez, you're in medical school and you've prioritized the time to write the book, to write the blog, to make the TEDx talk. Nina, new mother, doc, going through medical school, doctor now, I believe, and it's just in you, yet you guys still found the time on your calendar. Like, how are you able to organize your live. So you did get the work done amidst your very full plate of activities and responsibilities.
Well, we are both very hard workers, but whenever I try to do something alone or for myself, it's much harder to find the time because I feel like whenever I take time to write on a personal project, then oh, I should be reading medicine instead or similar problems. But I knew that Nina was at home writing, so I couldn't not do the same. I could not write, and she had the same feeling with me. So we competed against each other, and we were each other's motivators, I think. So whenever she had finished something, I got the text, and if I was behind on my part, I had to speed up. So yeah, that's another great thing about being two. I mean, we are very competitive people. I just couldn't let her beat me, I think.
So, how did you guys meet and become friends?
We became friends through this process, really, when we realized that we were so similar in our, work ethics, and of course, also the important things when it comes to friendship, like humor and I don't know, taste in movies. That's important too. But we weren't friends when we started working together. We were in the same class for a while, so we knew each other. But we were placed together because we were the two people who cared the most about female sexual health. So we were the biggest nerds. So we were like placed together against our will. Actually, we were asked to start the blog by a Norwegian newspaper after we did some work together for this sexual education organization. So I don't think I would ever have picked Nina to work with, and I definitely don't think she would have picked me either. But it was a strike of luck, really, because she's great to work with. And this book, I think this book became great because we have similar approaches and work very well together. So we were lucky. And now we're very friends. Now we're traveling the world together and have a lot of fun.
Do you think this is a book you could have, say the timeline was different. Say, like, 5 years from now, you're a bit more entrenched in the medical community. Is this a book you could have, like, if you can think of it that way, is this a book you think you could write from within the system, or do you guys still feel like you needed to be outside the system still to have accomplished what you accomplished with this book?
Well, I think part of our tone and the perspective, the way we can speak directly to a reader that's kind of on our level when it comes to education, and I think it was a strength to be from the outside of the system because then it was also easier to get that certain tone. A lot of readers tell us that it's like, reading advice from a friend, which is nice, I think. And also it's much easier to be critical towards the medical system while you're outside of it as a medical student and kind of an outsider. Because of course, we are critical towards how medicine has not prioritized female problems in a way. So kind of maybe we got a better view from where we were.
Is there any, have you guys worried that maybe the, like you said, like the tone you've struck with this book and maybe the way you've been somewhat critical of some of the medical culture, that it could sort of negatively impact your career as someone, as a medical professional, or is that something you didn't care about so much?
Well, I think we would have cared if that was an option that we thought lightly. But I mean, the the way we are critical towards medicine, it's more like an historical critique, and also we're trying to change how it is now. And a lot of doctors are doing that. A lot of people are trying to change how we work with women or female patients. So no, we weren't afraid of that. Actually, we've gotten a lot of support and good feedback from doctors, our professors at school, and we've gotten a lot of help actually. So yeah, and good reviews from doctors as well. So we feel that they have accepted these two non-experts writing about things they like. So yeah.
And as like lots of writers toil away in sort of obscurity and don't really strike a huge audience and so forth, and you guys, through the blog and the TED Talk and now the book being, you know, translated into, well, available in 30 some odd countries and translated into dozens of languages, you know, you guys have gone from relative anonymity to very visible. And how have you processed that, going from, you know, the Ellen who is, you know, just doing her thing, sex educator in Norway, to now almost being like a sort of global person and a global voice for this cause? So like, what, how have you processed that bigger visibility?
Well, I'm not finished processing it yet. I still think it's insane, but I'm very happy that since this project is what it is, no one is really asking me questions about my private life or about me. I think this is the first interview where I have discussed my childhood and also my opinions and feelings about the writing process. So I think this is one of the occasions that I've been sharing more of myself, even if this is not a very, you know, private interview or an interview that's focusing on private subjects. So we have been lucky because we have been able to have a great success without sharing our private lives, because a lot of people who have success in writing today are also bloggers and Instagram stars and celebrities, and you have to have a persona to have a success, I think. And it's very hard for writers who just want to write a good book and be a private person. I think that's becoming harder and harder. Also, how people are journalists, it's more about the journalist sharing his or her opinion on a case than actually covering the case. So we are lucky in the aspect that we are still private people, and also, of course, this is great because I always wanted to write. I always wanted to publish books, and I never imagined that anything could ever go this well. So I think I'm living my dream life right now. So of course, I'm happy about that. Yeah, popular science is fun.
Yeah, of course. And Ellen, where can people find out more about, like, follow you guys online, and if they want to learn a little bit more about your work, where can people find out more about you guys and what you're doing?
Well, they can follow us at Facebook and Instagram. We have our Instagram account is Wonder Down Under, and on Facebook we are The Wonder Down Under. And there you can find information about what we're doing and where we're at, and new releases and so on. And also, of course, our book can be bought online on Amazon, and yeah.
Fantastic. And before I let you get out of here, I just want to make sure I pronounce you and Nina's names correctly. So could you like pronounce your full name and Nina's full name for me?
Yeah, my name is Ellen Støkken Dahl.
Okay.
And Nina's name is Nina Brockman.
Fantastic. Well, Ellen, thank you so much for carving out some time of your morning here and as your U.S. tour gets started. This was a lot of fun for me in elucidating and very informative. So it was a pleasure to get to know you a little bit and hear about your work. And I wish you the best of luck with what you're doing. It's great work, and I can't wait to hear more from you in the future.
Well, thank you so much for having me here.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Bye. Bye.
All right, we've come to the end of yet another episode of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Show notes and fun stuff are all over at brendanomera.com. There you can subscribe to my monthly reading list newsletter, 4 books, and what you might have missed from the world of the podcast once a month. No spam. You can't beat that. Yeah. Subscribe to the podcast. Share with a friend. This is our little corner of the internet where we talk true stories. If you got someone who you think might be interested in it, why not just forward it along? I produced and conducted this show at Brendan O'Mara on Twitter and Instagram. Say hi. That's going to do it. We'll do this whole thing again next week. Sound good? All right. Have a see you an effing great week. Bye.